This is part two of our interview with Vinnie Money and Amy Gilson, researchers and science communicators from the graduate student group Science in the News. In this episode, we'll get practical advice on how you can start your own science communication student group. All right, so here we have Vinnie Money and Amy Gilson from Science in the News over at Harvard University. So thank you guys for taking a second to sit down and talk with us. And it would be great if you guys could just introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about what Science in the News does.
All right, so I'll go first. My name is Vinnie. I'm a graduate student in the immunology program at Harvard. I study how immune cells communicate with each other and how we can harness those communications to make better vaccines and immunotherapies. And I've been involved with Science in the News for the past 4.5 years, and we recently started this podcast. We're really excited about it.
Yes, we are. And I'm Amy Gilson. I just defended a week ago, as of the day we're recording this, my dissertation, so now I'm Dr. Gilson. And my my doctoral program was chemical physics, but really what I was studying was evolution, specifically how proteins, which are the molecules genes encode, evolve over billions of years. And like Vinny, I've been involved in SITN since the beginning, since I came to graduate school 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay, so you guys have been talking about SITN a little bit. What exactly is SITN?
So Science in the News is a graduate student organization at Harvard that's been around for almost 18 years, so it's almost an adult by itself. You can take out that corny joke later if you want to.
Oh, no, it's...
So SITN has been around for quite a while. It originally started with the goal of just communicating science to the general public, and this started out as a lecture series where graduate students would deliver lectures on a topic of their choice to the public in Boston, a very science-interested public. But I think over the years, we've also morphed into a secondary but a rather important goal, which is training the next generation of scientists to be effective communicators and also to interface with people that are non-scientists as they go throughout their daily lives.
So in addition to the lecture series, we also host science cafes called Science by the Pint, which we host in bars around Cambridge and Boston. And for those, professors come with his or her graduate students and chat with the people who are there about their work, field questions. We also have, what else do we have? We have the SITN blog, which Tyler used to be the editor-in-chief of, which is a really good resource for people who are interested in particular science topics. So one of our top stories is, why do you get colds in the winter? And why do you get the flu in the winter more often than in the summer?
And how do you guys do for viewership for these different kind of things that you do?
How do we what?
Do for viewership or attendance for the different things that you do.
So Science by the Pint is really, really popular. So we'll have a full room of maybe 40 people in attendance. The lectures,
and that's just at like a random bar somewhere?
Yeah. So we hold them at either the Burren in Davis Square, and now we've expanded over to Aeronaut Brewing.
There's one tonight, actually.
Yeah, you should go. It'll be fun. And over the past couple of years, we've actually had to shut people away because there's so much... so much of a crowd that shows up to it. We made the mistake of advertising on Reddit once, and we became a fire hazard for that one Science by the Pint event.
Cool. And what kind of topics have you hosted at Science by the Pint?
Maybe you remember better.
Oh, yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. So one of the coolest ones that we did, I think, we had, like, a history of science and the history of, like, Darwin versus... I'm blanking on the guy's name.
Wallace.
Yeah, Darwin versus Wallace. And there was a Darwin advocate and a Wallace advocate sort of going at it on stage. And then they brought the rest of their labs along and some of their students to come and discuss with the people that were attending.
Cool.
Right, both Darwin and Wallace put forward theories of evolution almost simultaneously, but Darwin is the really famous one. But there are some historians of science and scientists who think that Darwin actually didn't really understand and Wallace was the one who understood, so it's kind of contentious. And then one thing we mentioned very briefly is the podcast, which we both produce. And
what's the name of the podcast?
Okay, it's called Sit and Listen, right? Because SITN, Sit and Listen. I think we might change it to Science in the News podcast because it's a little bit more self-explanatory. You don't have to, like, explain the whole pun to people.
But if you look at our logo, we now have, like, a couch with headphones on it. It says Sit and Listen.
Yeah.
And that podcast is a little different from some of our other programs in that rather than sort of doing community building among scientists and interested people in the Boston-Cambridge area. It's more like community building among scientists and historians of science, philosophers, policy students on campus.
So you're getting a much broader swath of people who are working in these different fields or working on whatever topic you guys are talking about?
Right, because the podcast is really focused on understanding both sort of technical science, but also the social aspects and social context of that work. Mm-hmm. And scientists aren't necessarily experts in that, but there are historians who are experts. Mm-hmm. And so we want to work together with them to sort of educate ourselves and, you know, partially, at least that's my interest, and to sort of bring sort of rich stories around the science. Actually, this is consistent with the guest that you had on that I was just listening to, Tom McFadden.
Yeah,
where he was talking about how, you know, there's a shift now from communicating sort of clear science content to also trying to put that in a narrative, in its historical context, to show how scientists are doing the science.
Yeah.
And so this is one way that we're doing that.
Yeah. And is the blog similar in that vein, too, that you're trying to get people to understand process, or does it go more on focusing on a particular piece of content or something like that?
I think the blog is a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. So what we find, or what we're starting to find, is a lot of people that are reading the blog are going there essentially to get the outputted information.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the other goals, as we're morphing into this current political climate, is for scientists to be viewed as people. So cue the hashtag actual living scientist. And so we're trying to use the blog platform to push forward things such as the methodology, or this is what a scientist does every day in the lab, and we're trying to try to capture that in a bunch of different ways.
Yeah, one thing that we focus on with the blog here that I didn't really do so much when I was the head of the blog at Science in the News was focused on actionability, so getting people to be able to do something from the content that's within the blog post. It definitely would be interesting to see how that will fall into the kind of the direction you guys are moving in now, I guess, with getting more focus on process and getting people to actually do something rather than learning a fact. Not that there's anything wrong with learning a fact.
Can you give an example of an actionable point?
Sure, yeah. So it's a little bit easier for us. So if there's like a new plasmid that comes to the repository that somebody wants to write about, you could write about it just as, this is what people figured out using that plasmid. But what we'd rather is that we get information about, sure, what they figured out using that plasmid, but then what other studies could potentially be done using the technology that's within that plasmid. So we have suggestions on new experiments that people can do, or tips for how to use the particular technology, pitfalls that you could run into that you might not realize if you just read the paper, that kind of thing. So things that can actually help somebody out in the lab figure out what next step they should take in their research, as opposed to just looking at it and being like, oh, that's really cool, which often they are very cool, but much cooler if you can actually use it yourself.
That's great. One aspect of our blog, which is new, maybe 2 years old now, is we have really short blog posts, which are... the goal of those is to sort of break down a science story that's been in the media a lot and look at the way that the media has been covering it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so for example, one of the early ones that we did with these really short form blog posts was an article about how that year's flu vaccine was only, 70% effective. It's a couple years ago. And so the editor of that blog post sent the article to a science graduate student who had an expertise in that field. And they said, well, actually, that's pretty typical, and here are the reasons why that's typical. And so in the context of the current conversations around being sort of news literate, savvy news consumers, that style of blog post, I think, is sort of gaining like special relevance.
Yeah, because you can get the opinions of people who are involved in it much more quickly than like a long form thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right, and I guess that brings another process point from Science in the News' end and into consideration. So when we're doing these long-form blog posts, and also when we're preparing for lecture series and stuff, there's a lot of back and forth and a lot of editorial processes and peer-to-peer feedback that happens that actually gives rise to this less jargony format of whatever information that we're putting out there. And so with the short-form blog, what we wanted was to... have that quick enough turnaround that's with these newsworthy articles that we wouldn't really be able to capture if we were going about it with our regular processes.
And so now you guys are doing a lot of explaining on the podcast. Hopefully not mansplaining.
I'm incapable of it.
It's actually pretty much all womansplaining.
Even better. So what kind of thing, you guys have started the podcast, Sit and Listen, maybe soon to be the Science in the News podcast. What kind of things have you talked about so far, and what is the general goal of the podcast?
So far we've talked about genetic modification of crops and organisms, CRISPR, gene editing. We did a great episode on communicating science, which brought together sort of all of our experience on the subject and sort of laid it out there. One on allergies, and most recently we did one on mosquitoes and maladies, sort of ways to control mosquitoes, and a two-parter on animal experimentation. And the one that I'm working on right now is about climate change and urban planning. And for that one, we're doing things a little differently. So rather than what we've done previously, which is more writing our own scripts, it's much more interview-based, like this podcast. So we've interviewed the Cambridge Sustainability Planner, who's in charge of the Cambridge Climate Mitigation Planning. So what is Cambridge going to do if the sea level rises, for example?
That's a particular problem for Cambridge, right? Aren't there, if climate change gets particularly bad, essentially all of Cambridge is underwater?
Mm-hmm. So all of Boston is underwater, and Cambridge just has more flooding. Actually, yeah. So that's one of the things that
so
I learned from this podcast.
BU is gone, but...
Yeah, Harvard is okay. Harvard is okay, yeah.
I went to both of them, so.
Okay, so you'll be sort of sad, but also kind of okay.
Yeah.
And then we're also talking to the climate scientists who the city of Cambridge consults. And I'm really excited about that episode because I feel like that gets at exactly what we're trying to do, which is to sort of understand the interplay between social forces and scientific knowledge production. So, for example, we want to understand how do city officials come to have certain knowledge about the changes that their region is going to undergo. Are their needs driving climate science, for example, going the other direction? Like, we need to know, what kind of flooding there is to this level of detail. And then a climate scientist says, well, our models don't currently do that, but we need to, we'll update the models in some way so that you can get the information. So what's the flow there?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, one thing that I was really interested in is that it seems like the Cambridge city officials and the climate scientists don't necessarily talk directly, but the Cambridge city officials hired a consulting firm, Kleinfelter, to do a climate vulnerability assessment. So we're seeing whether we can also talk to them. And so that sort of gets at what the purpose of the podcast is, which is sort of, really look in detail about the dynamics of information flow and not knowledge generation, and balancing various sort of value and interests of groups. And the sort of back-end interest in terms of sort of like everything at SITN, there's also a goal in terms of science, in terms of graduate student training, is to build community of scientists and people who do science and technology studies and who are interested in sort of deliberating on these things and thinking about these things collectively, because currently there aren't really great mechanisms on campus to get scientists and non-scientists thinking about these things together in a really consistent way.
So kind of question for you guys, based off of all of that, that is a heck of a lot of work to...
Sure is.
...to coordinate all that stuff. So how is that jiving with, your goals in the lab? And I guess, Amy, you're almost out of the lab now, but is it easy to prioritize doing stuff for the podcast or even for SITN in general, or how do you do it?
Yeah, so it takes a village. And I think we're fortunate to have a good team of what we call producers. And now we're getting a lot of people that are interested in doing the podcast. So the way that we typically put an episode together is we may not be experts in that topic ourselves, but we're interested in learning about something like mosquitoes or space exploration or something like that. And we go out and we do the research. We come back, we write a script, and then we edit the script, and then we actually do the podcast recording process of that. And so, as you can imagine, that's a lot of work on the content front. So what we're trying to do now is basically take that content part, like the content generation, is going to be the responsibility of like more of the people that are going to be the correspondents, mm-hmm. per se. And then our job as a producer team is to chart the vision for what we like our podcast to be. So for the next few ones, like, I am in charge of maybe like one podcast every few months or so. And that's good because then we can divide the workload when I'm stuck at night in lab, you know,
sure.
hanging out at the microscope with my mice. I'll be like editing a podcast or thinking about what we're doing for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And so having that team is really important. And we've only sort of just morphed that. Like, we thought this was, when we first started it, and this is, I guess, going back to the goals a little bit. When we first started the podcast, at least my goal was, okay, let's take the SITN format and just put it in podcast, because a lot of people are listening to podcasts. But as we started to really dive into the research ourselves and putting these episodes together, one of the more interesting aspects of it was, you know, we don't really have a platform to discuss things that are at the intersection of science and society. And we as students, you know, we have access to graduate students in like the history of science department or other disciplines that might be able to shed light on this and would also like to speak on a podcast.
Yeah.
So this sort of bridges all of those disciplines together, giving us sort of this end goal of a podcast that we're putting out there,
yeah.
with scientific information, but also really putting a lot of emphasis on allowing the next generation of academics or scientists,
mm-hmm.
to be able to interface with each other.
Yeah, that kind of like crowdsourcing model with you managing, I think, works very... I mean, that's essentially how we do stuff with the blog, and it's how we do these interviews, right? Like, I just ask you guys if you want to come in, and we do that. And I definitely, I think it's a great idea because it gets a lot more people talking, so you don't necessarily have like this skewed vision of whatever you think is important necessarily, even though you guys are doing the managing. So that you get to have some kind of control there, which is good. And kind of along these lines, if somebody at a different university wanted to get started doing what SITN does, what would you say is the best kind of program for them to start doing?
The easiest program to start with, we say at any university, would probably be the Science by the Pint. That's relatively... you know, low effort in terms of getting the resources and getting enough people to start to put together a program. So for Science by the Pint, we go to a bar or pub and we say, hey, we want to host this event here. Would this be interesting for you? And then you contact a couple of professors who are good at talking to the public, or you contact a couple of graduate students or postdoctoral fellows that are, you know, personable, and then you have them do a short presentation on their research and engage other scientists. So that at least like starts this dialogue process. But if you have maybe one or two organizers as a whole, that's a lot easier to do than to, you know, start up a blog and then have people do many hours of editing per week,
mm-hmm.
on their own.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that we do organizationally that works really well is that for each program, for example, for Science by the Pint, we have two people running it at once. And so we always have a more junior and a more senior person, and each person runs it for 2 years, right? So the, you know, one person who's running Science by the Pint has already been doing it for a year, and then there's one person that they're training. And then after their 2 years are up, they leave, and now the junior person is the senior person, and they bring in a new person. And that allows us to have a lot of continuity in the sort of quality and workload associated with managing the programs.
As we've learned from Vinny and Amy, there are all sorts of ways to practice science communication. If you'd like to improve your writing skills, sign up to write for the Adjung blog by emailing us at blog@adjung.org. You'll get to work directly with me and develop an article about something going on in the world of plasmids and the biological sciences. We'd love to have you work with us. If you're interested in starting your own outreach programs like Science in the News, we encourage you to reach out to them at sitnboston@gmail.com. Until next time, thanks for listening to the Adjung Podcast, a better way to share science.